From News Talk 580-1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
With almost 40 million people, California is a large and complex state, and it's difficult for the average voter to know all the key facts of where they call home. Fortunately, there is one place you can go to find important information about the state and its government, the California Legislative Analyst CalFacts publication, a jam-packed 72 pages of charts and graphs covering every major economic and political issue in California, and it's published by our guest, Mac Taylor, California's Legislative Analyst. CalFacts, everything you want to know about California.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. As well as support from Era Energy LLC, Bonner Family Foundation, Community Medical Centers, Harris Ranch Inn and Restaurant, Nossaman LLC, Sagasser Watkins and Whelan, and Valley Children's Hospital. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Every 2 years, the California Legislative Analyst Office compiles a comprehensive look at the state in a publication called CalFacts. The California analyst, Mac Taylor, is here to talk about some of their findings. Welcome, Mac.
Nice to be back, Mark.
So let's start with the California economy. How big is it?
It's pretty big.
Big.
It's about $2.5 trillion, but I don't think that has much meaning to people. Mm. It's just a big number. But I think it put in terms that more easily understood, it's over $60,000 for every person in California.
Wow.
And that, if California were its own state, we'd be about the fifth largest, I mean nation, excuse me. If we were our nation, we'd be about the fifth largest in the world.
Goodbye, France.
Yeah.
Economic output, does it vary across the state?
Oh, very much. The real powerhouse region of the state right now, it's the Bay Area.
Right.
And as compared to that 60,000 average, their per person output is over 90,000.
Yeah, it's. I think I was reading your report, and I read this religiously. I want you to know that because it has so much good information in here. 93,599. That's a lot. And you compare that to the San Joaquin Valley. 36,000.
Yeah, the San Joaquin Valley and much of the north part of the state is just over a third.
Yeah, it's amazing the difference. So it is true, though, that California is the nation's leading farm state. What are some of the top valued commodities?
We do. Farming is still, obviously, agriculture is not, it's not the, one of the bigger industries, but it still probably makes up over 5% of our total output. So it's still very important, and we're the biggest agriculture producer in the country by far.
That is pretty amazing, though. You think how big agriculture is in California, yet it's only 5% of the state economy.
Yeah, but that's still a very important piece. And as I say, it's much larger than any other state.
We grow a lot of things here.
We grow a lot of things, and some of the big producers are milk, grapes, almonds. Cattle, I think, are our top four.
And a lot of those are from the Valley. I just
want to
mention that. Okay, so President Trump is talking about renegotiating trade deals. How important is international trade to California's economy?
Well, again, trade is probably 6-7% of our economy, our exports.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's very important. We're right here on the edge of the Pacific Rim. And our leading trading partners are, number one, the European Union. Maybe would surprise a little bit.
Followed closely, I would think it would be going the other way.
Well, closely followed by Canada and Mexico, mm-hmm. and then Asia, China, Japan, Korea, et cetera.
So the renegotiating some of those trade deals could have pretty major implications.
Yes, it could.
Okay, what about income levels? You were talking about the disparity between, let's say, the Silicon Valley and the San Joaquin Valley, but what about California generally compared to the United States?
If you look at just the top 5% of earners in each state,
mm-hmm.
California's top 5% probably average about $425,000 as compared to $350,000 in the rest of the country.
And they pay a lot of that. We'll talk about taxes in a moment, but they pay a lot of the taxes.
They pay a lot of taxes. So we do have a lot of very well-to-do.
Okay, so let's talk about the other end of the continuum. We're going through a lot of things here pretty quickly, but the other end of the continuum is unemployment and poverty. It seems like California is really a tale of two states. You've got the coastal California doing much better than inland California. Is that true?
Certainly on unemployment. In the Valley, unemployment rates are still very high, whereas some parts of the coast, you could almost argue they're below sort of a normal unemployment, full employment level. So in that sense, I think, yes, you do have two very different sort of Californians. We also have very high housing costs. That isn't so much that varies dramatically around the state with high poverty rates, which are affected by high housing costs.
Right.
And that varies throughout the state, but tending to be higher in Southern California.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about housing. There's good news and bad news there, I guess.
I mean,
the good news is, because housing prices in California are so high, that's a major part of people's wealth. You do mention that the flip side of that coin is it's also a major problem because of the cost of housing means what people are spending on housing is disproportionately larger, I would think, than the rest of the United States. So it's leading to poverty?
Absolutely. As far as the poverty measure and the reason why we have a very high percentage of people in the state under a definition of poverty that includes those housing costs is because we have very high rents and very high housing costs. Our home prices are almost 2.5 times what the average home price is in the country. Our rents are probably 40% higher than the rents in the United States. So we do have very high housing costs, and that's a very big challenge for the state going forward.
I remember years ago when I was on my honeymoon in Vancouver, and went to check out some, it was a very nice city, and went to check out some condo units, and they told me the price. I said, oh, that's not that bad. The person literally said, you're from California, aren't you? Because the prices here really are quite high compared to other places.
Particularly on the coast.
So the housing issue, still a big issue.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thanks for that quick snapshot of the California economy. What about state and local finances? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute, talking with California legislative analyst Mac Taylor about something they publish called CalFax. They do this every 2 years. A lot of key information there. Let's turn our attention to state and local finances. So let's talk about the main sources of revenue for state and local governments. How do they differ?
Well, they do differ significantly. For the state, we are predominantly reliant on the personal income tax. Although the state sales tax is our second most important source, mm-hmm. but those two really dominate the state fiscal picture. At the local level, it's property taxes.
You know, that kind of surprised me. I thought it would be sales tax, to be honest.
Well, sales tax is still important, but no, the property tax is much more significant at the local level.
And it is true that local government does get some revenue from other sources. The state provides local governments some revenue, and the federal government does as well. So let's talk about personal income tax, though, for a second. That's overtaken. Sales tax is the main source of state revenue. And by the way, it's also pretty volatile. So can you address those two issues? Why is it overtaken sales tax, and why are personal income tax receipts so volatile?
Yeah, if you went back to the 1950s, the state was completely relying on the sales tax. Personal income tax only raised about 10% of our general fund revenue.
And now it's like two-thirds.
And now it's almost just completely flipped.
Right.
Personal income tax is about 70% of our general fund, and the sales tax is less than 20%. Mm-hmm. And that's happened for a lot of reasons. Part of it has to do with the fact that we do have a lot of wealthy people. The financial markets have done well. We tax mm-hmm. capital gains. We have a very progressive rate structure. And on the sales tax side, we only tax tangible things, cars and computers, things you can touch.
Goods.
We don't tax services.
Okay. It seems like a triple whammy then.
Well, not a triple whammy. It's just that sales tax still does grow, mm-hmm. but it's a much smaller percentage. The sales of tangible goods is a much smaller percentage of overall income in the economy than it used to be. So we don't get as much money from the sales tax.
And you were mentioning that the personal income tax is very progressive.
Yes.
We rely quite a bit on the top 1%, don't we?
Almost half of our money that we get in the personal income tax in many years, especially good years, comes from the top 1% of taxpayers.
That's not wage income. That's capital gains.
That's
right?
That's all income. Personal income covers, wage and salary income.
But the spike isn't it like capital gains? Doesn't that have a big role to play here?
It's because those top income people rely much more heavily on capital gains.
So that means the stock market's very relevant here.
The stock market is incredibly relevant for our structure, and that's really one of the main sources of our volatility.
Let's hope the stock market keeps going up. Don't want to look at it when it goes down. So let's talk about corporate tax liability. How's that done over time?
Well, I think a lot of people may not realize that corporate tax is not a significant source of revenue anymore, so it's less than a tenth of our revenues. And it has not tracked as well with the corporate tax rate that used to. If you knew profits, you just took about 9% of those profits. Now revenues from the corporate tax are less than that tax rate, in part because we've allowed corporations to claim various credits and carry over loss deductions and things like that. And so we haven't been getting as much money from the corporate tax as we did.
So you start with the number, but then you have all these deductions.
Exactly.
Okay. So another issue is you hear a lot about is, I can't even say it, budget. A ballot budget, ballot box budgeting, sorry, it's a mouthful. There's a propositions like, Prop 13 that limited property tax increases, or Prop 98 that sets a minimum guarantee for K-12 education. What impact has ballot box budgeting, I got it out, had on state and local finances?
Well, it's had a dramatic effect on the state, and I don't think anything more than Proposition 13, which fundamentally changed the relationship between the state and the locals limited local, the main source of local revenue, property taxes, and it changed the relationship amongst the two levels of governments. But I think when you talk about ballot box budgeting, you're usually thinking about how did those initiatives constrain the legislature from acting year to year.
Well, that's Prop 98.
Well, that's Prop 98, but also think about the various tax increases over the last 10, 15 years that voters have approved.
Right.
And they've typically been for things, a very specific purpose, smokers, right. Millionaires.
Somebody else.
Well, somebody else, but if you think even in Prop 64, marijuana.
Yeah.
There are significant increase taxes involved in Proposition right. 64. All of those monies that are raised are designated for certain purposes. The legislature can't use them for whatever purpose it wants, so that's really where the constraints come in.
So let's talk about the expense side of the ledger. How much has the state spending over time? Has it increased dramatically, kind of stayed the same? What about expenses?
Well, certainly state spending has gone up over time, but we like to sort of control for, you know, population growth and inflation. And maybe one simple way to think about it is how has the state's spending as a part of the overall economy? That is it growing faster mm-hmm. or not? If you go back to the 50s and 60s, 70s, the share of the economy taken up by state spending grew significantly. About 4% to 8% of the economy. But since like 1980, it really hasn't changed as a percent of the economy. So it's growing. It's just not growing as a share of the economy.
So if we've only got about a minute left in this segment, I want to ask you two quick questions. One is, what are the major expenses in the state budget? And the second, something about long-term liabilities. What are the long-term liabilities? Are they being addressed?
Sure. Well, we spend over half of our budget, our general fund budget, on education, either for schools, community colleges, or the two university systems. Mm-hmm. And then the other two big pieces are the Medi-Cal program, which provides health care to low-income people, and our criminal justice system, the courts mm-hmm. and the prisons. We have some large liabilities, mm-hmm. getting close to $300 billion. We're setting aside monies to pay off many of those liabilities, like pension cost and our bonds, but we still have to address retiree health care.
Just put that in context. What is an annual state budget?
The general fund budget is about $125 billion.
So we're talking about almost three times,
a couple times.
Right, a lot.
Yeah, but if you think about your debt as a homeowner, you might have debts that exceed what your annual income is.
Right.
The question is, you're making payments each month to pay them off, so you just don't want those debts to get out of hand of what you can accommodate.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks for the overview of state and local finances. Up next, education, the largest expenditure in the state budget. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking to California's nonpartisan legislative analyst, Mac Taylor. California's public education system, kindergarten through college, is the largest in the country. It's also the biggest expense in the state budget. So, what are the primary sources of operating revenue for K-12 education?
Basically, the state provides most support for school districts. We raise the money, but we send a lot down to districts, but they're also supported by property taxes and some federal dollars.
Okay, and I think the breakdown, the percentage I read in your report, are 60% from the state, 30% local, and 10% from the feds. So that kind of gives you an idea where the money's coming from. Let's talk specifically about state funding for education. How much is provided per student, and how is that determined?
Well, let's just talk about Proposition 98, which in effect sets doesn't set a maximum, but it has generally determined the amount that schools have for their basic operations. And we're certainly currently spending about $10,217 per student.
Sounds like a lot.
It does sound like a lot. And the way that we do it, we send money down to districts, and they have a lot of control over that. We basically have a target to give every student the same amount of money. However, in addition to that, we give extra money when a child is low income, English learner, or a foster
youth. A little bonus, it sounds like.
It's like a 20% bonus.
Right.
Then in addition, a district can get additional bonuses if their concentration of those particular students is more than 55% of their district enrollment.
And this is a bit of a change. In the past, there was something called categoricals where the state would say, okay, here's the money, but here are the strings attached. Now they're saying, here's the money, so this thing called local control funding formula, you decide how to spend it.
We're still giving these extra amounts based on categoricals of the past, say,
right.
you know, low income. It's just that we determine the amounts, we send the money, they determine how to spend it.
Local control. Okay, so let's talk about some of the key metrics of education. Teacher pay, class size, enrollment trends. What have you found there?
Well, there's a basic trade-off here. We have very high teacher salaries in California, some mm-hmm. of the highest in the country. But as a result, we tend to have some of the highest class sizes mm-hmm. in the state. We typically rank towards the very bottom on that. So obviously there is a trade-off there.
Right.
And that's the sort of mix that we've decided on, at least at this time.
Yeah, it seems like if you lower the pay, then the teachers couldn't afford to live in California. So you have to increase the pay. So the way that works out is you have larger class sizes.
And of course that varies a lot by where you are in the state.
Right. So what about the special challenges when it comes to K-12 education?
We have, as we talked about, we have those low-income kids, mm-hmm. which are about 60% of the student body of, in K-12 education. So you obviously have some challenges there dealing with lower-income kids. You have special education, which is about 10% of our students. Now, a lot of those special education is for very relatively minor disabilities, you know, speech impairment and things mm-hmm. like that. But there are some much more serious special education problems that are funded through that special amount. And we also have, you know, English learners, too. Right. So we have a variety of things that we still
but
try English to account
learners
for.
Learners are a big part of the school population. I was reading one-fifth or almost 2.7 million students are English learners.
Well, there's 2.7 that they can speak a different language at home.
Okay.
We have about a quarter of our population that are considered English learners. They're not proficient in English.
Right.
And that's a very big challenge.
Yeah, and that's going to obviously affect school scores, and when you're comparing California scores maybe to other states, it affects that, I would assume.
It's something you wouldn't want to take into account when you're comparing interstate scores.
Yeah, let's talk about California's public universities. Are they very popular to do? A lot of Californians like to go to CSUs and UCs.
The California is a little different from the rest of the nation in that we educate more of our college students at public institutions. Over three-fourths go there. So our University of California, our California State University, and our community colleges, who take in the most students, are a very important part of college education in this state.
And you look at some of the other states where they might have a public university system. Let's say University of Connecticut, that's one public school, but then you've got some other, like Western Connecticut, et cetera, but then you've got Yale University and Fairfield and, you know, Wesley, all these other schools where kids go to. We don't have quite as many of those, it seems like,
not,
in California.
Not as many.
Okay, what about, how expensive are California schools, higher education? Are they a lot more expensive compared to their comparable universities?
Yeah, I think you really have to break it down by segment. So, for example, on the University of California, our tuition tends to be at the higher end of the range, probably in the top, you know, 20% mm-hmm. of their comparable institutions. It's a very different story for CSU, the state university, where we're in sort of the bottom sixth of tuition cost.
A good deal, you would argue.
It's a very good deal, and community colleges are the best deal.
Right.
Because not only are our tuition rates for a full-paying student the lowest in the nation by far.
Wow.
There's about two-thirds of the units that are taken where students don't pay anything. They get fee waivers.
Yeah, that's a great way to kind of get your 2 years done if you're going to get a four-year degree, get your 2 years done at a community college in California. Are students graduating on time? I mean, it used to be you went to college for 4 years. That seems like an anomaly these days.
I think we're dating ourselves, Mark.
Right, we are.
If you look at how many kids are getting out of UC in 4 years, it's about 60%. Mm-hmm. For CSU, it's under 20%.
Wow.
And now we have been making improvement in recent years. Those have been edging up, but it's still, I think we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, a lot of students are working while they're going to school, which makes it, you know, takes longer to
get
through.
And I'm not sure there's a big problem there. I think it's when you have more full-time students who are just not getting through in the time they should.
Yeah, well, thanks for talking about that overall view of education in California. Up next, we're going to discuss some of the other important state programs that the state delivers, things on poverty, crime, health, transportation, and the environment. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Hebler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Mac Taylor, head of California's Legislative Analyst Office, that publishes CalFacts 2016, a compendium of facts about the state. And we're going through a lot of them.
Yeah.
Education is the biggest expense on the state budget, but there are a lot of other important programs that the state funds dealing with poverty, health, crime, natural resources, transportation. So let's discuss some of those programs. First up, human service programs, the major ones like SSI, CalFresh, which is food stamps, in-home supportive services, CalWORKs. How big are they in the state budget, and what can you tell us about those?
Well, they're not like crucial pieces of the state budget, but some have been growing rapidly. For example, you mentioned the IHSS, which is in-home supportive services.
That's to get people to stay at home, so they don't have to go to a nursing home. They can kind of stay in their own home.
Older or disabled people right. who are at threat of being institutionalized are going to a nursing home, exactly. And that program has grown rapidly, but it's still, as far as spending on it, I'm just looking at the number, it's about $3.5 billion on a budget of $125.
And by the way, the population's aging, so there's a lot of people that are interested in these kinds of things.
This is one of those programs that does, where that explosion of baby boomers moving into past 65 will have an effect on the budget. So that's a growing program. CalFresh, you mentioned, is probably the widest used social mm-hmm. service program. Almost 4.3 million people get these.
And there's about, 39 million in the state? Total population,
yes.
something
yes.
like that? So it gives you an idea how big it is.
That's almost entirely federally funded, though,
okay.
so it doesn't have the implications on the state budget. And then you have what's called SSISSP. That's just income support to low-income seniors and disabled people. And you have, developmental disabled people. We provide a lot of services to live in the community.
Okay. So let's kind of transition a little bit to talk about health. What can you tell us about Medi-Cal?
Well, Medi-Cal, which provides health service to low-income people, is one of our biggest programs. It's probably 18% of our budget, and it's grown significantly
Is that number two to education as terms of expense in the state budget?
It's less than that. I mean, 17%. Again, schools are, K-12 schools are probably 40% of the budget.
Yeah, and then would that be number two in categories? Would that be the next biggest expenditure? I'm thinking it probably would be.
Yes, it would. Okay. And this is a program that's grown fairly dramatically over time.
Well, you have the ACA, Obamacare probably.
That has boosted it in recent time as we expanded our program. We put more people into Medi-Cal. But it also, it sort of encouraged other people that maybe were eligible to claim it. So it's a very significant part of our overall budget plan, knowing what's happening in Medi-Cal.
Now, you know, a lot of people think, if you ask them, you know, what is the biggest expense of state government, they'll say, oh, incarceration and crime. Really not, not so. It's a big expense, but it's like down the list. Can you tell us about a little bit about crime and incarceration rates in California? What's going on there?
Sure, yeah. The overall, say, corrections budgets, our state prisons, is less than 10% of our overall budget, which is still a significant piece. It had grown dramatically in the 80s and 90s, but now it's sort of tailed off, in part because we've taken actions to slow the growth of incarceration. First of all, crime rates have dropped dramatically in the last 30 years.
And people don't realize, we're at historic lows. There's been a little bit of an uptick, but we're at historic lows.
Historic lows, and that's true in California, it's true in the nation.
Right.
But because of the problems we had in our state prison with overcrowding, we realigned many lower-level services down to the counties.
And that whole issue with realignment was, according to the courts, we had too many people in our prisons. It was over capacity.
We couldn't provide adequate health care because of the overcrowding.
Okay. And so they had to get some of those people out or build more prisons.
Build more prisons. We did both. Right. But we did shift a lot of lower level people to the counties. But even as a result of that, we still have a lot fewer people that are incarcerated in state prison and even in local county jails.
Yeah, because they I don't want to say decriminalized, but they lowered some used to be felonies down to misdemeanors, and that also had an effect. Let's talk about environmental stuff, you know, water, energy, greenhouse gases. What are some of the key facts you can tell us about natural resources in California?
Well, certainly water has been a big issue because of the extended drought. We hope that we may be getting over that. But it did result in some real negative effects that persist beyond any sort of, above average rainfall that we might have experienced recently. Groundwater depletion, which is very important, particularly in the Central Valley. The impacts on the state's forest.
Yeah, I just want to talk about groundwater for a second. So they're taking all this water out, and what they're seeing in some places is actually subsidence, where the land actually goes down. And that has implications for roads
buildings,
all kinds of infrastructure.
And it's hard to get that stuff back.
Right.
So you have implications for that, for the state's forest. We have a lot of dead trees that can have persisting effects over time if you don't take care of issues like that. And then as far as electricity, what you're seeing there is the state is trying to move more towards renewables.
Right.
We're trying to get to eventually half of our electricity retail sales that are in effect are provided from renewable sources.
And they're moving in that direction.
We are moving in that direction, but that's going to be an ambitious goal.
You know, one of the big parts of greenhouse gas emissions is transportation, cars. I'm wondering, do Californians love their cars? How much do we drive, and how are those roads paid for?
Well, we have a lot of drivers. We've got about 26 million licensed drivers, licensed drivers, which is about 85% of all people over age 16.
Mm.
So we do like our cars. We drive about 35 miles.
What percentage are good drivers? I'm going to ask you that question. So a lot of drivers.
We drive an average of about 35 miles a day. So, our transportation system is really crucial for the economy, for mobility, to get around, for our lifestyle here in the state. The way we finance those roads is typically through gas taxes, taxes on fuel, diesel, gasoline. Although local governments also use sales tax add-ons. Most counties, urban counties in particular, have typically had a quarter cent, half cent, or even more that are dedicated to transportation purposes.
Well, I got a few more seconds left in this segment. I just want to ask you quickly about bonds. What role do they play with infrastructure?
Bonds provide about three-fifths of the financing for infrastructure. In fact, if you're not talking about transportation, which is funded on an ongoing basis by gas taxes, bonds are by far the dominant way that we pay for almost all of the other infrastructure.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst, for being here. Covered a lot of ground. Please look on their website if you want to see more of this in detail. There's a little book. If you want to stay current with state and local politics, you can sign up for our daily newsletter, The Maddie Daily, by logging on our website at maddieinstitute.org.
Up next, a state as large and complex as California is bound to have its share of legal disputes. Increasingly, however, judges are ringing the alarm.
There's a crisis in the federal courts. What is it, and what does it mean for criminal prosecutions and civil litigation? We'll ask. Lawrence O'Neill, Chief U.S. District Judge. McGregor Scott, U.S. Attorney. Richard Waters, from Miles, Sears & Yanni, and Daniel Jamison, from Dowling Aaron.
Welcome. So can you have justice without judges? That may be more than a rhetorical question. Our guest, for example, Lawrence O'Neill, the chief U.S. District Judge for the Eastern District of California, has expressed deep concerns about what there is, seems to be a dwindling number of federal judges and what that may mean for justice for many Californians. Welcome to the Maddie Report.
Thank you for having me here.
So before we discuss the judicial crisis being faced by the federal district court, can you briefly describe the federal court system? Our audience may not know all the ins and outs. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, the federal court system is one of limited jurisdiction, which simply means that unless it has to do with the United States Constitution or an act of Congress, we have no jurisdiction, no power to act. That's the difference between the Superior Court, which is a county state court, and the federal court.
And the federal court system. And so, of course, there's the district court, the trial court, which you're responsible for, then there's a court of appeals, and, of course, the Supreme Court.
Yes, and what we call the district court, circuit court, United States Supreme Court.
Okay. Circuit court, court of appeals, so that
right,
kind of works together. Okay. So you're the senior judge of the Eastern District for California. What's the size of the Eastern District in geography and population?
Well, we encompass 55% of the state of California, and it goes from the center of the state east and from the Los Angeles border to the Oregon border. It's a huge district. We have more than 8.2 million people in the district, so it is a very large district, not only population-wise, but also geographically.
Yeah, and I think you sent out a note talking about this issue, and one of the things I noted in your note was that in terms of population, the Eastern District is larger than 38 states. That's a majority. And then when it comes to geographic size, it's larger than 41 states.
That's right.
That's a large district.
Well, that's why when we go back east, we talk about it, and the district judges there can hardly believe that my statements are accurate.
Yeah, pretty huge. But you're the chief judge.
I am.
What are the responsibilities of a judge for the U.S. District Court?
Well, in addition to having a full caseload that every district judge has, I have all the administrative duties of the Eastern District. We have 28 federal judges within the Eastern District that include district judges, magistrate judges, senior district judges, and bankruptcy judges. So it deals, my job deals with economics, the budget, any personnel issues, basically the administration of the court.
Can you just briefly describe this, a senior judge versus a magistrate judge? What's the difference?
A senior judge is a district judge who has gotten enough hours and enough years and enough age to retire, but they work for free.
Wow, that's a commitment. And a magistrate?
Magistrate judge is appointed by the district judges. District judges are nominated by the president and confirmed by the entire United States Senate, and they're appointed for life. Magistrate judges are appointed by the district judges for six-year terms, and they can, of course, be renewed.
That's amazing. The senior judges are doing this for free. I mean, that's pretty amazing. And you said there are about 28 or so judges total in the Eastern District?
Total, including bankruptcy judges.
So if you do the math, and I did the quick math on this before we started the program, it's about one judge for every 300,000 people.
Well, it's worse than that because there are only six judges, district judges, in the entire district. And magistrate judges don't have the same powers that district judges have, especially in the criminal realm. So you have to start dividing by six instead
of by
28.
Okay, now you've got half a million people. One judge for every half a million, 500,000 people. That's one judge for the city of Fresno, essentially. That's a lot to cover. So you're saying that the caseload is increasing for each judge, obviously because there's so few judges. How much has it changed over time? How does it compare to the caseload for other district court judges nationally?
The last new district judge we had, additional one, was in 1978, and the population was 2.5 million people. Now, I've just indicated that the population is more than 8.2 million
now.
It's
more than tripled.
And we still have six district judges. We are dealing with, each district judge has approximately 900 cases each. The average in the entire nation.
When we say 900 cases, at any one time?
At all the time, because some are coming in, some are being resolved. But generally, the amount is approximately 900.
And how does that compare nationally?
The average per district judge nationally is 435.
So twice as much.
More than twice as much.
That's amazing. Well, you know what they say, that justice delayed is justice denied. And as the cases mount and judges retire, the federal court is increasingly backlogged. How do we get to this point? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Senior Judge for the U.S. District Court, Lawrence O'Neill, about the growing crisis in the Eastern District of California, an exploding caseload, and a dwindling number of judges that can actually hear those cases. Now, it's getting to the point where we may have to rethink the saying, you shouldn't make a federal case out of everything, to you won't be able to make a federal case out of anything. So the last district court judgeship you mentioned was in 1978. How has the district changed since that time?
Well, it's gone from 2.5 million people to more than 8.2 million people. The complexities of the cases have exploded. The water law has become more and more complex by the minute.
That is an incredibly complex area of law. In fact, the first issue I ever got as a lawyer was on riparian rights, and I had to go look up, what are they talking, what's a riparian?
Yes. Yeah, they are very, very extensive cases, and I am a pretty concise judge when it comes to writing opinions. Mm-hmm. The smallest number of pages that I've had in a water case is 76.
Wow.
In an order. They're very complex.
And you're dealing with, let's multiply that by 900 cases you're dealing with. Not all of those are water, of course, but you don't need very many water cases to keep you very busy.
That's true. And of course, we haven't even touched on criminal cases.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this. So this issue with the lack of district court judges, is that a common problem in other district courts, or is this unique to the Eastern District?
In between. There are some other districts in the United States who have what we call emergency needs, but most of them are doing just fine, and they do not have the problems that we have, thus the average per district judge of 435 cases.
It's much less. So, you know, apparently 10 years ago, the administrative office of the courts, kind of the administrative agency that kind of helps run the courts, said that you guys needed 4 to 6 more judges to handle your caseload. 10 years ago.
And it wasn't just 10 years ago. It's been every year since then.
Okay, fine. It's been going on, but nothing's happened. Why?
That's a good question, better asked to people in Congress, the senators of the state of California and the Congress people in the Eastern District of California. We have the need. There is no one who questions it. I have presented before the United States Congress on this very issue, and there was nobody who disagreed with the need. They just have not acted.
Okay, I'm guessing politics are part of the equation here.
It's always part of the equation.
Of course. So, you know, you were talking earlier, you said you had senior judges, you had magistrate judges, you've got visiting judges that come in and help on occasion.
We do.
Why isn't that a viable long-term solution?
Because the visiting judges have other cases of their own, and when it comes time for trial, it is no longer possible or viable to them to continue on with these cases. We've had more than, in the last 3 years, we've had more than 1,000 cases handled by visiting judges, but it causes tremendous administrative burdens on our clerk's office with no additional clerk help from Washington, D.C.
Yeah, so what about senior judges? Is it just the burnout with senior judges? I'm doing this for free. I'm not going to take on another 900 cases for free. Is it a burnout issue?
It's a burnout issue. It certainly is not a financial one. If it were a financial one, they wouldn't go senior at all.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of by the time that they are eligible to go senior status, they're worn out.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you said, listen, we're on a short fuse here because you've got a number of people that are going to be retiring shortly. You're down to six.
We've got a third. A third of our district judges are retiring in the next 14 months.
Yeah. So you're talking about catastrophic consequences if more district judges aren't assigned to the Eastern District.
Exactly.
So how is this going to play out for the general public?
It appears as though, based on the additional United States attorneys that are being hired, to prosecute criminal cases, coupled with the fact that the United States Constitution provides that criminal cases take precedence over civil cases, that it is very unlikely, unless we have additional judges and the replacement of the two that are retiring in 14 months in a very timely fashion, that we will not be able to handle any civil cases commencing February 1 of 2020 in 14 months.
Any civil cases?
Any.
Wow. So you got the criminal division, the district U.S. attorney, they're ramping up. I don't want to say you're ramping down, but the judges, fewer judges, so this is a bad combination.
It's a catastrophic combination, and that is what's changed. Judges have accommodated the problem for the last 10 years, for the last decade or more, but by working just harder and harder and harder, but it's not possible
anymore. Okay, well, up next, we're going to talk to some of those practicing attorneys about what they think about the dwindling number of judges to hear their cases. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. So what would the shortage of judges mean for those who litigate cases in front of the California Federal District Court? We're going to ask, first of all, what happens in criminal cases with McGregor Scott, the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of California. Welcome.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
So the Chief Judge noted in his discussion that your office has announced you're going to have 12 new prosecutors. Why so many?
Two things. Number one, the Department of Justice received its best budget in literally decades in this last go-around on the budget. So it's a matter of now having the money to fill all the positions that were authorized, because historically the office has run about a 10% vacancy. And combined with that, we've received four new lawyer positions, three of which are devoted to violent crime here in the Eastern District, two of which will be based here in Fresno.
So it sounds like there are big problems here. So I assume that means you're gearing up for a lot of criminal prosecutions. What impact will this lack of judges, of federal district judges, have on those cases?
It's going to have a significant impact. We are up well over 20% fiscal year 16 to 17, and another 20+% 17 to 18 in the number of criminal cases brought here in the Eastern District. A classic example of the problem is that in the spring of 18, judges in Sacramento were setting criminal trials in 2019.
Wow.
So 8, 9, 10 months out from the trial setting, which is just, you know, justice delayed is justice denied.
Right.
And that doesn't work for anybody under any set of circumstances. The other problem we have, by way of example, here in Fresno, approximately 6 weeks ago, we had 6 criminal cases set for trial this week, all confirmed for trial with 2 judges. That doesn't work.
Yeah.
So
some cases are getting moved.
Well, some things are getting moved around, but the bottom line is that neither the United States government nor the criminal defendants, for the most part, are getting their right to a speedy trial.
That's a big deal. Well, up next, we're going to talk about civil cases. We recently talked to 2 experienced civil litigators, Richard Waters with Miles Sears and Yanni, and Daniel Jameson with Dowling Aaron, about the impact on civil cases. Well, Rick, welcome. You know, we're talking about too few judges, and I assume their priority is going to be given to hearing criminal cases over civil cases. So my question is, isn't that going to make the situation even worse for civil cases that you handle?
Well, the priority has always been criminal cases first. In the Eastern District, it's been difficult the entire time I've been a lawyer in terms of getting cases out there. And back in the 80s, there were cases where you'd have a trial date set, and the judge would summarily just go ahead and take your case off calendar and pick a new date some other place. But it's gotten worse. And now you go ahead and you file a case, and we have one that we filed in the Eastern District in Sacramento, and it's been pending for 3 years, and we do not have a trial date. And we have another one in Sacramento that's been pending over 2 years, and it finally has a trial date, but we could easily get to the trial date and not have a judge.
Would you say it's gotten exponentially worse?
It's worse than it's ever been. And so you file in federal court if you have a federal question, if the U.S. of A is a defendant or there's a federal question, or if you have diversity of citizenship. And on diversity cases, the defense can go ahead and remove you and have you go to federal court. They can have you go there if they want. So if you file there, you're waiting a long, long time, and then you don't have any assurance that you will get a trial date.
So, Dan, what does it mean for your clients in handling civil cases? This is justice denied?
Well, let me give you some examples. Say you're a business and your business burns down. Your insurance company is an out-of-state company. They claim that you misrepresented whether you had fire extinguishers in your plant or facility. So they sue you in federal court as an out-of-state citizen entitled to sue a local resident. You desperately need that insurance money and need to get the issue resolved. You can quickly prove that you had the fire insurance, fire extinguishers, and could...
It sounds like it's going to take you 3 years or something.
Well, that under the problems that we're now facing in approximately a year, that case will not move at all. So the insurance company will sit there, and they won't have to pay, and you may end up going bankrupt. Take another example. Say you're a farmer that's upstream, and you're a downstream farmer who is a neighbor of that farmer. Federal law may impact and cover the rights of the parties relative to that water. If the upstream farmer takes water that the downstream farmer objects to, and it's harming that farmer's crops or livestock, Well, then he wants to sue in federal court to get a determination of this, but it won't move. So what do these people do? They end up potentially showing up in a Hatfield-McCoy type situation where justice is taken to, in that case, it would be potentially the Fields or the House, but justice is taken to the streets if the courts aren't open. And that's the real problem that we're facing.
That's a serious problem. But one of the things we're going to look at next is the hyperpartisan nature of the confirmation process. Is that causing a backlog? Is there any hope of toning things down and maybe addressing some of this growing shortage of district court judges? We're going to have that conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute, and we're talking with Judge Lawrence O'Neill, the Chief U.S. District Judge for the Eastern District of California, who's mentioned that if this problem of lack of judges, the shortage of judges, isn't addressed soon, we may have a situation where the federal courts are really going to be unavailable to a lot of people who live in most of California. So what is the solution? Is there a short-term fix here?
There really is no longer a short-term fix. We thought there was for a while. We thought that it was only going to be a short-term problem, therefore a short-term fix would work. That has not happened. This is a long-term problem that needs a long-term fix. And the only fix is more judges.
Now, it's been going on for 10 years, so it's getting a little long in the tooth. Well, let me ask you this. You know, if Congress does act on your request, it's bound to be politicized. I mean, particularly since the Democrats are still pretty upset about the Republicans deep-sixing Merrick Garland for the Supreme Court. Of course, Republicans would argue, hey, wait a second, they did that to Robert Bork. The bottom line is that it seems like the judicial selection process has become highly politicized. Is there anything that can be done to make this process less political?
Truly, the process has always been political. It's just set up that way in the United States Constitution, that the sitting president, who is obviously elected from a political standpoint, does the nomination. The United States senators do the confirmation, and they're all politically appointed or elected as well. So it is a political process. The problem occurs when the people involved in the process stop talking with one another and stop negotiating with one another.
Well, you've gone back to Washington and you've asked them, say, hey, this is our problem, we need more judges, and apparently no effect? I mean, do they talk to you afterwards and say, hey, we understand your concern, we just can't do it?
I had one talk to me, a senator talked to me right after I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and his position was, we don't want the president of the opposite party to appoint. Well, that's always going to be true. Yeah. That is never going to change. What needs to change is the attitude and a respect for the Constitution, because the Constitution does provide that the sitting president has that power. We simply need the resources. It's Congress's duty to provide the resources needed, and it's the president's duty to nominate.
So it sounds like some of this is Congress is shirking its responsibility in some respect, but it's also, you can maybe talk about folks, and are we just too litigious? Just too many cases being filed? Maybe that's the problem?
Well, we have everybody who knows where the courthouse is, whether it be state or federal. And in some way, in some cases, absolutely. You look at a case and you think, this is going nowhere, and it will last for a while through motions, and that's time-consuming. But it goes nowhere, just exactly how you saw it at the beginning. But there's no way around that. The law allows that. And the law requires judges to pay attention to the cases and see them through.
Yeah, you basically have a right to bring a case if you want to bring a case, generally, and
that's right. You, that's all it takes is a complaint and a filing fee, and you're in.
Oh, and also the issue of habeas corpus and some people who are in jail filing complaints. I assume that's a big part of your docket?
Well, not just, usually the habeas cases are in from the prison after they've been sentenced.
Right.
And the civil rights cases, we have a lot of prisons in the Eastern District of California,
right. And
we have a lot of civil rights complaints.
Well, that's actually a very unique part of the Eastern District, right? You've got a lot of prisons here.
Yes, and we have a lot of cases from the prisons.
Yeah. So what about technology? Is that the answer? Just be more efficient through the use of technology?
We've already done that. We're a paperless court. It's all computerized. And in some ways, that has sped up the process of getting the cases to us, but it doesn't speed us up.
Yeah.
We still have to read, research, and decide.
Well, let me ask another question. You know, a lot of times, you know, clerks out of, you know, students out of law school,
yes,
and clerk for a federal judge. What about hiring more full-time lawyers to do that kind of work?
I have five working for me now, just for me. And I don't have time for a sixth. And what I mean by that...
Because it's still going in the same funnel. It's still ending
it
up funneling
is.
To you.
You're suggesting that the funnel at the top get wider,
right.
But that hole at the bottom is me.
Right.
And it doesn't get any bigger or more expansive or create more time for me.
That's a good answer. So let me ask you this. What about alternatives to litigation? You hear about mediation or fact-finding or arbitration. Is there a way to get some of these cases, you know, out of the courts?
Well, the magistrate judges have done a great job in that regard. They actually even now go out to the prisons. They don't just wait for lawyers and parties to come in for settlement conferences. They go out to the prisons where many of them are representing themselves, and they're not free to come into the court for settlement conferences. But as far as mediation and arbitration, most contracts, frankly, have arbitration clauses, and they're required to go there at least first. Sometimes it's binding arbitration, and it circumvents the courts altogether. But all of those things are going on now.
Yeah.
So and have been for quite some time. It's just we've got more judges.
You've looked under all these other possibilities, and it really comes down to just a simple fact. You just need more judges.
No question about it.
Okay, well, I want to thank the judge for being with us today and our other guests as well. If you want to stay up on state and local politics, you can log on to our website at MattyInstitute.org or check us out on Facebook and Twitter. This is Mark Kepler for the Matty Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views expressed in the Matty Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Matty Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Matty Report, visit our website at mattyinstitute.org.